Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Terms apply.
Summon your anticipation for an all-new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. This season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix May 16th. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop starting May 2nd.
Welcome to Criminalia, a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio.
The Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. has a fake crystal skull. And so does the British Museum in London, as does the Quai Branly Museum in Paris. As of 2019, it's estimated there are roughly a dozen to perhaps as many as 30 crystal skulls known to exist and long considered pre-Columbian relics. It's difficult to pinpoint how many are out there. They're kept in private collections mainly, with just a few on public display in museums. And they're essentially exactly what you think. Human skulls carved out of quartz, and they range from a couple of inches in height to about the size of a bowling ball. They're wrapped up in history, lore, and Hollywood. They inspired Steven Spielberg's 2008 action-adventure movie, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. They inspire theories about the occult, aliens, and psychic abilities. But the reality is, none of it's true. The part about them being skulls made of quartz crystal, that part is true, mostly. They're actually just trinkets, like the kind you'd pick up as a tourist on vacation, but in the late 19th century, many were sold by a French dealer and swindler as authentic artifacts. Welcome to Criminalia. I'm Maria Tremarchi.
And I'm Holly Fry. Public interest in ancient cultures was high in the mid to late 1800s. Museums were eager to please, and a man named Eugène Bobon had what they wanted. Bobon's name will appear throughout our story of these skulls because, and considering this is the season of forgeries, this is hardly a spoiler alert, it was not Aztecs or aliens or something supernatural behind their existence. Bobon was their provenance. He originally left France at the age of 19 to join California's gold rush, but he failed to strike it rich. By 1857, he was in Mexico City, passing himself off as an antiquarian and art dealer. He befriended everyone he could and listened to their stories, and he learned to speak both Spanish as well as Nahuatl, which is the Aztec language. He lived there in Mexico for years.
His arrival in Mexico coincidentally happened to be when the War of Reform, also known as the Mexican Civil War, began. But that effort to overthrow the government failed. During a subsequent conflict known as the War of the French Intervention from 1862 to 1867, Napoleon III, seeing opportunity to expand the French Empire in what was considered the New World, invaded Mexico. It also followed Mexican President Benito Juárez's suspension of interest payments to foreign countries, which, as you may imagine, ruffled a few feathers. In 1865, Bobon, who at this point was deeply steeped in the local culture, was named an archaeological consultant to Napoleon III's Scientific Commission, a team that surveyed the country and then produced many illustrations for scientific reports as well as travel books. The expedition also collected Mexican and Central American art and artifacts for France, work that Bobon then parlayed into a business of exporting Maya and Aztec objects. He began calling himself the antiquarian to the emperor. By the late 1860s, he had acquired, along with numerous archaeological artifacts, a sizable collection of religious art. Bought or stolen? You pick. The Scientific Commission sent a selection of his pre-Columbian artifacts to France for show at the 1867 Paris Exposition in an effort to illustrate the achievements of that ancient empire.
In March of 1869, Bobon sailed from Veracruz to Paris after 12 years in Mexico. His friend, Dr. Francisco Fenelon, wished him safe travels when he left, but also wished him the successful sale of his collection, writing, quote, "Flood France with your curiosities and squeeze all the ugly metal out of them that you can in exchange." And he did. During the 19th century, there was an increased interest among the public and among scholars regarding Mesoamerican sites and artifacts, and that led to an increase in the trade of pre-Columbian objects and fake pre-Columbian objects. Through catalogs and exhibitions, Bobon sold artifacts to both collectors and museums. He also kept a shop in Paris called Antiquite Mexicaine and exhibited many of his objects at the Ethnographic Museum in the Palais du Trocadéro in Paris. The Trocadéro was the first anthropological museum in Paris and the precursor to Paris's Museum of Man. He wanted to sell his collection quickly so he could return to Mexico with a small fortune in hand.
It's a little bit early to take a break for a word from our sponsor, but we're going to do it. When we're back, we'll talk about how the crystal skulls have long been misidentified as genuine, as well as how each of the museums we mentioned came to have them in their collections.
Hey, everybody, it's Holly. Listen, I've been doing stuff on stage since I was a kid, which means that I have been doing my makeup since I was a kid. And I can turn out a look when I need to, but on my day-to-day, I really like to keep it a little more relaxed and low-key. I don't have time for a full face most of the time. But that also means that Thrive Cosmetics can have me covered no matter what I'm doing, whether I'm doing something on stage, like I have an appearance or a live show, or I'm just running to the grocery store. Something in their line is perfect. And what I really love and what's important to me is that they are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free. And to me, cruelty-free is very important in the cosmetics I use. I mentioned that I've been doing my makeup for a long time. I've gotten older in that time. And one of the things that I've done to refresh my look is switch over to their Brilliant Eye Brighteners and use something like a rose gold shade to really like go all around my eye and then just blend it out and get a daytime smoky look. It makes me look a little more youthful and more refreshed. And it's just easy as pie, and it means that I don't have to mess with a whole ton of products. Refresh your everyday look with Thrive Cosmetics, luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 10% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/criminalia. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/criminalia for 10% off your first order.
Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by SimpliSafe. Listen, you listen to true crime podcasts. You know that the world can be dangerous and unpredictable and that there will, unfortunately, be people who want to hurt each other. And so it's kind of nice to get a little peace of mind by having a good home security system. Just take a few precautions. And I recommend looking at SimpliSafe Home Security. I've had my home broken into in the past, and it was a terrible feeling, even though nothing that bad really happened. Aside from an intruder, I just really like knowing that I have a security setup that lets me check in on my pets when I'm not home. That is a huge peace of mind giver when I am out traveling. SimpliSafe sent me a whole home security system, and I was really, really impressed by the variety of indoor and outdoor cameras they offer. And the whole thing is backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than $1 a day. Get 20% off any new SimpliSafe system when you sign up for Fast Protect Monitoring. Just visit simplisafe.com/criminalia. That's SimpliSafe, SimpliSafe.com/criminalia. There's no safe like SimpliSafe. Welcome back to Criminalia. Let's start talking about how modern researchers figured out the truth, or at least some of it, behind the crystal skulls.
Though there are more than 1 to 2 dozen known crystal skulls out there, we're going to tell the stories of 3 specific ones, the ones that helped researchers figure out the truth.
So that brings us to our first crystal skull, the one at the British Museum. This crystal skull made its debut in 1881 in Bobon's Paris shop. He later exhibited it. But after he tried to sell it to the National Museum of Mexico, claiming that it had been excavated in Veracruz, he was outed by a curator there who suspected the item was fake. Accused of smuggling antiquities, Bobon quickly left Mexico again, but this time he did not return to Paris. He opened a new antiquity shop, but this time in New York City. And that turned out to be a very good decision in regard to the Aztec artifact forgery business.
It's there where he sold a crystal skull to American entrepreneur and real estate developer George Sisson. It then passed to American George Kuntz, who purchased it for $1,000 on behalf of Tiffany & Company at an auction held in New York City. At the age of 23, Kuntz joined Tiffany's as a gem expert. Everything written about him suggests he was a gem prodigy, and he remained there as vice president of gemology and noted mineralogist until his death in 1932. The skull displayed at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Years later, it was auctioned off by Tiffany's and bought by the British Museum in 1898. There, it was displayed as a genuine Aztec artifact, next to legitimate Olmec, Maya, and Aztec objects in the museum's pre-Columbian collection. Because they thought it was.
Bobon also sold a crystal skull to French ethnologist, collector, and explorer Alphonse Pinard, who in turn later donated the skull and much of his collection to the Trocadero. In 2006, the majority of the museum's collection passed to the Quai Branly Museum. It would later be discovered that Pinard had not actually organically collected the items that had been donated in his name to the museum. He had purchased all of those objects from Bobon. This crystal skull is now known as the Paris skull, and it continues to be housed at the Quai Branly Museum.
Museums weren't ignorant about fakes, but reports suggest the problem was often that they didn't have enough information to identify and avoid bringing forgeries into their collections. And because of that, they started relying on subject experts for help in evaluating artifacts. And that's how Bobon got his foot in the door. He built a reputation as an expert in Mexican antiquities, and museum curators trusted him to arrange deals on their behalf. When it came to an artifact such as one of these crystal skulls, for instance, it's unlikely that curators would have identified a forgery, because at that time in history, there wasn't a lot of good information about Aztec culture, nor did they have the tools we have today to investigate. Our French con artist took advantage of that, and then hid the skull's origins through fake purchase histories.
After American archaeologist William Henry Holmes visited Mexico City in 1884, he saw what he called, quote, relic shops on every corner, filled with fake ceramic vessels and figurines. The influx of fake objects in private and public collections was becoming such a problem that in 1886, Holmes wrote an article called The Trade in Spurious Mexican Antiquities for Science Magazine.
Nearly all of these crystal skulls have, at times, been misidentified as genuine Aztec, Toltec, Mixtec, or occasionally Maya, but none reflect the artistic or stylistic characteristics of any of those cultures. For instance, Aztec and Toltec versions of death heads were carved in basalt, sometimes covered with stucco, and almost always painted. Additionally, the Aztecs displayed the skulls of sacrificial humans on racks, impaling each horizontally through the parietal temporal region of where the brain would have been. The Mixtec, too, occasionally fabricated skulls, but they were created out of gold, not quartz. These objects had skull-like faces with intact eyes, noses, and ears. And the Maya, while they too carved skulls, they did so in relief on limestone.
Our third example is a crystal skull that just showed up in the mailroom of the Smithsonian. One day, back in 1992, a heavy package addressed to the non-existent Smithsonian Institute Curator, Mesoamerican Museum, Washington, D.C., was delivered to the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. An unsigned letter inside the box stated, quote, "This Aztec crystal skull, purported to be part of the Porfirio Diaz collection, was purchased in Mexico in 1960. I am offering it to the Smithsonian without consideration." Richard Alburn, then curator of the institution's Hispanic American collections, contacted Jane Walsh, an anthropologist and researcher specializing in Mesoamerican archaeology and ethnohistory at the Museum of Natural History. Did she, he wanted to know anything at all about what he described as an eerie, milky white crystal skull that, in size, was about as big as a football helmet? Walsh knew of the crystal skull on display at the British Museum, but not much else. Alburn offered the skull to her department for the National Collections. If it was a genuine pre-Columbian Mesoamerican artifact, it would not only be very rare, but also very special.
According to Walsh, she had some doubts about the authenticity of the skull from the moment the package arrived at the Smithsonian. Of the time period and the skulls, she has stated, quote, "After Mexican independence, a lot of outsiders started coming into the country and collecting historic pieces for museums. These collectors," she added, quote, "created a demand, and local artisans then created a supply. Some of the things sold to these foreigners may not have been made to intentionally deceive, but certain dealers claimed that they were ancient."
When they first surfaced in the 19th century, experts at the time attributed these skulls to various, quote, "ancient Mesoamerican cultures." And that was that. Roughly a century after Bobon's skullduggery, today's chemical analysis techniques helped museum researchers determine whether or not the skulls were authentic. But modern investigation also helped track down who Walsh initially called the, quote, "mysterious obtainer of rare antiquities." But who was he, this person, who surely knew the origin of the skulls?
We read a description that Walsh's sleuthing expedition was worthy of Mr. Holmes, and that's dead on accurate. Walsh began with the skull she knew about, the one at the British Museum. She contacted them to discuss crystal skulls, and that conversation proved to be the catalyst for researchers on both sides of the Atlantic to begin the investigation that finally proved these objects were fakes. 60 years earlier, some experts had begun to doubt the authenticity of the crystal skulls, according to Margaret Sachs, a conservation scientist at the British Museum. But for a long time, researchers, quote, didn't have the scientific means to follow up.
The British Museum and Smithsonian researchers, including Walsh and Sachs, began collecting evidence that their skulls were likely not of Aztec origin, a project that continued through the 1990s and the 2000s. A small bit about the provenance of the skull in London came from an old catalog entry for the British Museum that said in its listing, quote, "Little is known of its history and nothing of its origin. It was brought from Mexico by a Spanish officer sometime before French intervention in Mexico between 1862 and 1867. It was then sold to an English collector, after whose death it passed into the hands of Eugene Bobon before being sold to George Sisson in New York City." Those dates are interesting because the research team went on to discover that there was no evidence of any crystal skulls before the 1860s.
Beginning with just simple observation, Walsh wrote of the British Museum skull that, quote, "the proportions were off. The teeth and circular depressions at the temples did not look right, and overall, it seemed too rounded and polished." And about those teeth. In Aztec art, the research team noted, teeth were represented as they looked like in people's mouths at the time. The skull's teeth should have reflected that they came from an era without modern dentistry, but instead, the teeth were perfect, too perfect, wrote Sachs.
A close look at the surface of the skulls revealed nothing that would support the theory that they were pre-Columbian artifacts. Researchers chose an authentic Mesoamerican crystal goblet from the National Institute of Anthropology and History in Mexico City as their benchmark. the goblet had been recovered from excavations at Monte Albán in Oaxaca. Sachs examined the skulls using a high-powered scanning electron microscope and learned a few interesting things in comparison with that legitimate goblet. The surface of the authentic goblet had irregular etch marks. That was a sign that the piece was carved with handheld tools. But the surface of the skulls in question had regular etch marks that could only have been made with modern carving implements, such as a rotary wheel and hard abrasive, things that appeared long after the Aztec Empire.
The team also discovered that the British Museum's skull had what researchers called, quote, worm-like inclusions in the rock crystal. Raman spectroscopy is a technique that analyzes the interaction of light and matter to determine a material's makeup. And researchers used that method to determine that these inclusions were actually an iron-rich chlorite mineral. While it's found in rock crystal native to Brazil or Madagascar, it's not found in Central America or Mexico. Researchers also noted a small deposit of something within the Smithsonian's skull. With X-ray diffraction, a technique that can determine the crystallographic structure, chemical composition, and physical properties of a material, they determined there was a deposit of silicon carbide inside. Silicon carbide is a synthetic abrasive that's commonly used in stone carving workshops, but not until the mid-20th century.
We're going to pause here for a word from our sponsors, and when we return, we'll talk about the examination of the Paris skull and the conclusions the research team came to regarding all three of these skulls.
Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Summon your anticipation for an all-new season of our favorite Netflix series, Bridgerton. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? And meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. And I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix May 16th. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop starting May 2nd.
Welcome back to Criminalia. So let's talk about this Paris skull.
So then there was the investigation into the provenance of the Paris skull. This crystal skull was part of Alphonse Pinard's collection, purchased directly from Bobon, and today housed in the Quai Branly Museum. Walsh traveled to Paris to examine the artifact with the French research team. This skull stands about 4 inches high, and it has a large hole drilled vertically through its center. There is a comparable, though smaller, skull, about 2.5 inches high, in existence, and that smaller version serves as the base for a crucifix. Experts believe the larger Paris version may have had a similar use. The Paris skull, like the other two, did not pass muster when scientific tests were applied. It was in Paris where Walsh met Marie-France Fauvet-Berthelot, an archaeologist at the Museum of Man and curator of pre-Columbian archaeology. Through her, Walsh heard the name Eugène Bobon for the first time on a small pamphlet entitled Museo Científico, which advertised a private museum Bobon opened in Mexico City in the mid-1880s. One of the items listed in that museum was a crystal skull called a, quote, masterpiece of lapidary technology and, quote, unique in the world. This was the moment, Walsh stated, where she knew that Bobon was the key, yet he remained in the shadows.
And she would be the one to drag him out of those shadows. Walsh wrote that through found correspondence, she was able to learn about Bobon's business activities, including sales, as well as who he traded with and which museums had purchased items from him. And she'd gleaned that his collection seemed to have been significant in size. Eventually, through things like newspaper articles and business receipts, she was able to put some pieces together about his life in France, Mexico, and in the United States.
But it was several letters exchanged between Bobon and George Kunz, remember, he purchased a skull for Tiffany's in the late 1800s, that held a clue. The letters included a note about retrieving a box for a skull, and that raised eyebrows among those investigating. To Walsh and the research team, this was additional evidence that, at the least, the British Museum skull had most likely originated with Bobon. She would then go on to find in her research that he had sold crystal skulls to dealers who then sold them to collectors and museums more than 100 years ago. Walsh said of the discovery, quote, most of the objects he sold were legitimate, but his big ticket items were for the most part fake.
The conclusion? There was no direct tie to Mexico for these three skulls, except through Bobon. Of their skull, the British Museum wrote, quote, it bears traces of the use of tools unknown in the Americas before the arrival of the Europeans. These traces and the high polish of its surface indicate that it was carved using traditional European techniques. Similarly, Walsh wrote, quote, all of the crystal skulls had been carved with modern coated lapidary wheels using industrial diamonds and polished with modern machinery. The skulls were estimated to be from the mid to late 19th century, though because of the silicon carbide found inside, Walsh felt that the Smithsonian skull might be even younger, carved perhaps in the 1950s. While it's clear that these are not pre-Columbian artifacts, as you can tell, there are still some mysteries surrounding the crystal skulls.
As for the mystery of where Bobon acquired them, Walsh has theorized that he may have taken many of his objects from aging Christian churches in Mexico during his travels, especially during his expeditions and during the ongoing wars that were happening while he lived there. But there is also evidence to suggest that the skulls were made in the workshops of Idar Oberstein, a German town renowned for crafting quartz objects. Further examination and investigation led researchers to this interesting fact. Though they're almost always attributed to pre-Columbian Mesoamerican cultures, not a single crystal skull is found to come from a documented archaeological site. The team declared all known crystal skulls must be fakes. Over the decades, additional research has found a few of the allegedly crystal skulls are actually glass. A few of them are even made of resin.
The crystal skulls have undergone serious scholarly scrutiny, but they also tap into our imaginations. Non-scientific theories about their origins are abundant, and they've been subject to much speculation over the years. Some people still believe the skulls are the handiwork of ancient Maya or Aztec cultures. Some believe they originated on a sunken continent or the legendary island of Atlantis. Others believe they came from a faraway galaxy, proof that extraterrestrials visited Earth, and specifically, the Aztecs. They're also the subject of discussion on occult sites and social media. Pseudo-theories about them claim a lot of things, that they have paranormal powers, that they can cure disease, and that they can give you psychic abilities, including premonitions. Joshua Shapiro, co-author of Mysteries of the Crystal Skulls Revealed, has written, quote, we believe the crystal skulls are a form of computer which are able to record energy and vibration that occur around them. The skull will pictorially replay all events or images of the people who have come in contact with them, meaning they contain the history of our world. Most archaeologists and other scientists, though, are skeptical of the paranormal theories surrounding these skulls.
Although the British Museum admits and exhibits its crystal skull as an example of a fake artifact, others still describe them as genuine. Mexico's National Museum, for example, identifies its crystal skulls as the work of Aztec and Mixtec artisans. Ultimately, Walsh stated the truth behind at least a handful of these crystal skulls may have gone to the grave with Bobon. Because he dealt in the sale of these crystal skulls as well as other pre-Columbian artifacts, he is often considered the source of all crystal skulls, but there isn't any evidence to support that. He surprisingly may have hinted that there was something suspicious going on in the crystal skull business in an interview with an American newspaper in 1900, where he stated, quote, "Numbers of so-called rock crystal pre-Columbian skulls have been so adroitly made as almost to defy detection and have been palmed off as genuine upon the experts of some of the principal museums of Europe." What he leaves out is, "by me." Right back at you, Eugen.
That quote is really something. Talking about yourself.
It's pretty great. The idea of him as a sneaky devil who is like, "I'm hiding in plain sight. I just told you what
exactly.
I'm
here's my catalog.
It's really your fault at this point. And he delights me so much that I'm naming this week's bogus bevy after him.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, we're calling it Bobon's Secret. And this is one where I wanted to think, of course, because Mexico and Mexican culture figures so prominently in this one, I wanted to do something tied to a Mexican favorite of cocktail culture. And I thought, we've done one that looked like a margarita already. I thought it would be fun to do something that looked like a paloma. If you don't know what a paloma is, it's very delicious. A paloma is made with tequila, grapefruit juice, lime juice, simple syrup, and club soda. That's kind of a variation, according to some folks. Some people say the original paloma needs to have grapefruit soda, which is my preferred version, and it is delicious.
Which I love grapefruit soda, so I am on this.
Oh, who doesn't? I don't like grapefruit, but I love grapefruit soda. I don't understand it.
Me neither, but I love the soda, yeah.
For Bobon's Secret, we want to make something that looks like a paloma, that has that nice orangey peachy look to it and has some bubbles and is delightful. So here's what we're doing. We're going to keep the tequila. It just feels right. We haven't done a tequila drink in a while.
It's been a while.
This one, listen, this one surprised me in a good way. It's going to start with 1.5 ounces of pineapple juice and then 1/2 ounce of lemon juice. And then you're going to add, and some of this is taster's choice and some of this is color matching, because pineapple juices don't always have the same color. So you want to use your artistic eye to gauge, but you want to use 1/8 of a teaspoon to maybe a little more of paprika. And you're going to add that in. And that will bring the yellow up to that orangey, slightly pinky color. And then 1.5 ounces of reposado tequila. And then you're going to shake that in your shaker like we do so many drinks. You're going to shake it a lot because you really want to incorporate that paprika. The lemon juice is going to help break down the little granules of it, but you really want to give it a vigorous shake. You're going to strain that into a Collins glass and you're going to top it with a 2 ounces of club soda. And then if you're me, you're going to taste it and immediately say, "We must always have paprika infused pineapple juice at the back bar because it's delicious."
I bet it's delicious. I did not try paprika in a drink until you introduced me to it.
It's delicious. And I don't know that I have done paprika infused pineapple juice before. It does something different that it doesn't taste like anything you're expecting. It doesn't taste pineapple-y quite. There's the sweetness and there is something that has a tropical vibe in there. The paprika shifts the gears so much that it just tastes like something completely new to my palate anyway. And I love it. And it's great for people that I think you would like it because it cuts the sweetness and it's not a hyper sweet
drink.
It
doesn't seem like it would be. Yeah, I like fruity drinks, but not a lot of like simple syrups. So this sounds like it could be right for me.
Yeah, the flavor is very light. And it's one of those things that I just feel like it's a little dangerous because to my palate, and I'm not the biggest tequila drinker, it obscures all of the flavor of tequila. And I'm like, this could be a danger to myself and others. If you make these, please be careful. The mocktail is easy as pie. You're just going to leave out the tequila and up the soda a little bit.
Easy.
That's all.
Super easy.
And then it's like a really easy sipper. That's when I will put in like a 32-ounce giant thing and just be slurping on it all day because that's delicious. You could just make that in a pitcher. And then if you have a mixed group of drinkers and non-drinkers, you can add your tequila or not, depending on what anybody wants, which is nice. Anyway, that is Bobon's secret. And the secret is paprika and pineapple is really delicious together. I highly recommend it. I'm not kidding when I'm like, I have to set aside some sort of vessel where that is all that's going on forever in my back bar, because I could see that going well with like a bourbon, vodka, easy peasy. With a gin, it's going to be pretty interesting because that floral, the floral notes of a gin are going to pull out those flavors in a different way. I'm excited to play with paprika and pineapple juice. We're also excited that we still get to share these stories with you of crimes of days past. And we hope that you will join us again next week. We'll be right back here with another forgery and another forged drink. Criminalia is a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from Shondaland Audio, please visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Summon your anticipation for an all-new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. This season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix May 16th. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop starting May 2nd.